So, okay, we'll just start by reading the scripture. We're back to Luke. For those of you who missed last week, what we're doing is we're going back and forth between the Gospel of Luke and the book of Daniel in the Old Testament. So last week we had our very first sermon, the first opening verses of the book of Daniel, and now we're in the middle of Luke, which we've been doing for quite a while now. Okay, so here we go. This is in the middle of a long teaching segment that Jesus is giving to his disciples, and so we'll just, yeah. Oh, 12. Chapter 12, verse, I don't have it up there. It starts at verse 35, I believe. Okay, so let's just read this together. Be dressed for action and have your lamps lit. Be like those who are waiting for their master to return from the wedding banquet so that they may open the door for him as soon as he comes and knocks. Blessed are those slaves whom the master finds alert when he comes. Truly I tell you, he will fasten his belt and have them sit down to eat, and he will come and serve them. So this is all an extended metaphor, right? If he comes during the middle of the night or near dawn and finds them so, blessed are those slaves. But know this, if the owner of the house had known at what hour the thief was coming, he would not have let his house be broken into. You must also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour. So throughout this passage and the next passage we're going to look at, the theme is sort of is preparation. The theme is being prepared for God. So there's two different warnings here and two different images of God. There's this image of a master and servants who are at the house, or slaves at the house, and you know, the relationship they're in. And then there's a thief and coming in, breaking into a home. These are two different kinds of images of God, and begs the question, why would Jesus paint God as a thief and also as a benevolent master? A benevolent master is coming home, and then a thief who's breaking in are two very different types of God. He doesn't extrapolate on this. He doesn't interpret this later. What I take it to mean is who God is depends on who you perceive the owner of the house to be. So if you're the owner of the house and you own everything, then someone coming into your house unexpectedly is, by default, a thief. Whereas if God is the owner of the house and owns, you know, your life and your possessions, etc., then by coming, he's the master. So it really is a question of, it's you, not really. It's not that Jesus is jumping randomly back and forth between these images, but it's how you perceive God. And in fact, it talks a lot in the Old Testament and New Testament, for that matter, about how, you know, when Christ returns, how that's going to be perceived differently by different. It's called a day of wrath, a day of judgment, a day of glory, a day of salvation. I mean, it kind of depends on where you're at as to how you're going to perceive it and how you will experience it. So just to get to this first part, this is the NIV translation, I believe. Sometimes Bible translators try to be a bit delicate, which I understand. A bit of delicacy can go a long way, but really what that says at the beginning there, the parts that I have in green is, be dressed for action is gird up your loins. So it's loin girding in view here. What that is, I mean, it's pretty basic, as you've probably seen pictures and images and whatnot, but people back then tended to dress in sort of long, flowing robes. And so if you had to do labor, or if you had to run, or do anything that required a lot of movement, that's very hindering. So you would actually belt up your robe, this is what they call girding up your loins, to free up your legs, basically, so you could do it. And it came to be sort of colloquially described as just get ready, you know, be prepared, you know, gird up your loins. So it's the exact same verb as that he will fasten his belt. They really didn't want to say gird up, they didn't want loins in the New Testament. So they say, blessed are the slaves, and the master finds the Lord, he comes straight to tell you, he will gird up his loins, in other words, get ready, and then have them sit down to eat. So just a bit of Greek trivia. It's not a good sermon unless you can mention things like that and get people interested. Oh, that's intriguing. So the theme, as I said, is being prepared, and that's what that word is about, being prepared for action. In the Bible, this will come as no surprise to most of you, over and over again, Jesus indicates that what God is really interested in your heart and with you, it's not whether or not you're perfect or whether you're sinless, because you're not perfect and you're not sinless. And so that's a given. You know, like we talked about last week with Daniel, his sins being a footnote in the book of Daniel. So that's just a given. What God's interested in is something more subtle, more nuanced, and sometimes hard to define, which is that, are you prepared for God? Are you ready for God? You might remember the parable, for example, of the man who's caught naked at the wedding feast. It's like all of our biggest anxiety dreams, you know, like you're preaching naked or whatever you're doing, you're naked. And Jesus says it's like not being prepared for God is like being at a feast or official ceremony and you're not wearing any clothes. I always thought it was interesting. He tapped into everybody's deepest fear. Who hasn't had the naked dream? Don't raise your hand. I don't want to. Most everybody's had the naked dream, I think. Anyway, so I'm off base again here. So being prepared, that's what's at issue. That's what's at stake. And the interesting thing, if God finds you prepared for his arrival, if God finds you dressed or prepared or your loins girded up or whatever metaphor we're using at that point, if he finds you that way, then God will be prepared for you. That's what that, blessed are those slaves and the master finds the Lord. When he comes, truly I tell you, he will prepare and have them, the slaves, sit down to eat, and he will come and serve them. Now, presumably you don't have to be an expert in ancient Greek history to know that that's not exactly the normal way of things. That's a switching around of the normal roles. If he comes late at night and finds them so prepared, then he will prepare for you, and he will serve you. And of course God will ultimately serve us, because everything we have is from God. Our lives, love, our futures, everything of importance, everything is from God's hand. So of course God ultimately serves us. We really have nothing of our own to offer back to God that he hasn't already given us in the first place. So that's a natural statement. That's an expectation. So that sort of prefigures this next paragraph. We go ahead and put up there. This is the one I wanted to spend more time on this morning. And Peter says, Lord, are you telling this parable for us or for everyone? And Jesus ignores that. And the Lord said, who then is the faithful and prudent manager whom his master will put in charge of his slaves to give them their allowance of food at the proper time? Jesus often does this in the Gospels, is that someone will kind of want to know, who are you really talking to? Almost always the answer is everyone. And so what he does is he puts the question back on you, the most famous one being, who then is my neighbor? And then he tells a whole parable about who a good neighbor is, implying that everybody needs to be a good neighbor, like Allstate or State Farm. Wow. Any rate, Peter says, hey, who are you talking to? And God says, well, Jesus says, who's the faithful and prudent manager? And of course, he's putting Peter and the disciples in charge as managers, if you will, over churches and etc. So Peter says, Lord, are you telling this parable for us or for everyone? Lord said, who then is the faithful and prudent manager whom his master will put in charge of his slaves to give them their allowance of food at the proper time? Blessed is that slave whom his master will find at work when he arrives. Truly I tell you, he will put that one in charge of all his possessions. So of course back then there were layers of slaves, if you will, and so this manager is a house manager. He's in charge of the slaves in the house. And he says, and Jesus says, who's the faithful and prudent manager? Blessed is the slave whom his master will find at work when he arrives, because he's fed the other, if you'll notice, he's taken care of the allowance of food for the other slaves. So in other words, he's taking care of his fellow slaves. Blessed is that one. And when the master gets home, he'll be put in charge of all his possessions. Now, there's only one person who's put in charge of all of a master's possessions. Who's that? Not quite. Try again. No. Stop! It's not God or Jesus. Okay, it's the son. It's the inheritant. The person who the son is the one who eventually gets all his possessions. So the master, the manager of the household, and it becomes treated like the son, the inheritor. He gets everything. But if that slave says to himself, and this is where it gets a little dark, my master is delayed in coming. And if he begins to beat the other slaves, men and women, and to eat and drink and get drunk, the master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect him and at an hour he does not know, and will cut him in pieces and put him with the unfaithful. So it's not subtle. Let's go to the next one. That slave who knew what his master wanted, but did not prepare himself or do what was wanted, will receive a severe beating. The one who did not know and did what deserved a beating will receive a light beating. From everyone to whom much has been given, much will be required, and from the one to whom much has been entrusted, even more will be demanded. So, it's a question of what you know and what you believe and what God expects from you in turn. Now, every single sermon, I will not stop saying this. I know some of you are really bored of me saying this, but every single sermon where we talk about slavery in the Bible, I have to put in the slavery caveats, which is that this is not American slavery, such as we know slavery. There's not a good word that translates slavery for us here in English, so that's the best word the Bible translators can use. But this is a different system than what we're used to. For example, it's not race-based. And so you can have, you know, and did have in the Roman Empire and beyond, Italians or Africans or people from all over being in slavery and being free, etc. It had nothing to do with the color of your skin or where you were from. It was more of an economic reality. And at this time, at the time of writing, up to somewhere between a third and a fifth of the entire Roman Empire was slaves. And so you had slaves. And the other thing was you could go in and out of slavery. Someone could purchase your freedom. You could purchase your freedom under a certain. You could sell yourself into slavery if you wanted to pay off a debt, etc. It was a much more fluid thing. And so there were abuses with slavery back then. If you were a slave, you had no rights before your master. Your master could, as we're reading, could beat you, could kill you. That was true, but it wasn't the same sort of, for lack of a better word, sort of demonic thing that we had here in the United States of race-based and intrinsically evil. It was a different feel. For example, if you knew a slave, like if we were in church together and say Chris was a slave and I was a free man, I couldn't just go and abuse him. I couldn't treat him like dirt. Plus, next week he might be freed. So, I got to be careful about who I treat like dirt. And some slaves in this time became very powerful, had slaves of their own, were wealthy, had mansions of their own. So you understand it's a more nuanced thing. Secondly, this is a parable that Jesus is talking about. And as I said, thousands, hundreds of thousands of people were slaves in the old Roman Empire. He's not condoning slavery. He's just using the experience of slavery to express something true about God. It's not like Jesus saying, so this is a good thing when masters come home and beat them.
Is this the difference between slavery and indentured servitude?
It's much more similar to indentured servitude, except it really is taken, it's taken to a, you really don't have any rights. An indentured servant might have some rights before it's his or her master. Slaves didn't have any rights before their master. And it could be abused. Like, you wouldn't want to be a slave in the Roman mines. Your lifespan was very short, and you would be, I mean, there's a gradation of it. So I know when we talk about slaves being beat and this kind of thing here in our culture, often the images I'm referencing anyway are images that just aren't from that time period. So we need to be careful about that and not take our history back to there. Slavery is never good. Jesus never condones slavery, says it's great, this is something a little different. It's not quite as evil as what we experienced here in the States. Okay, all right. That probably was a bit too long. That was not supposed to be that long, but I think it's important to say those things. So my main point, if you go back one slide, my main point this morning, when I'm preparing sermons and I'm reading a passage and it draws me in and I get involved in the minutia of it and I feel like God is telling me to preach from this specific thing. Sometimes I feel like God sort of knocks me out into the stratosphere and it puts me into a wide-angle lens, and I feel like what God is saying is preach something bigger. Does that make sense? This one knocked me back. I went back into a very wide-angle lens, and I really got fixated on this passage. So at that second dot, if that slave says to himself, so the manager of the other slaves in the household, if that slave says to himself, my master is delayed in coming, and if he begins to beat the other slaves and so on, and that phrase of my master is delayed in coming really stuck with me, and that's what I started thinking about. And I got to thinking about life as a whole. You know, the big questions of life, you're familiar with them. What is this world? What are we doing here? Why are we here? Why is there pain and suffering on the one hand? Why is there so much delight and joy on the other? What role do I have, if any? What is my significance here? Do I have any significance here? All the questions that anybody who reaches a certain level of maturity, they're going to have those questions, invariably. What does all this mean? I would say that the answers that we decide are true to those questions, the answers that we decide are true to those questions, are the most important decisions of our lives. That is the most important decision of your life. Of what you decide is going to be true and what the answers are to those questions. And I think most people here, know that popular culture is not really a good place to find the answers to those questions. That's not where we should be looking. It's not where we're going to find life. We find death there instead. You know, there's many different permutations of it, but popular culture might infer that the most important question of your life is how successful will you be? How attractive are you? How smart are you? Who will you date? Will you date? Who will you marry? Will you marry? Will you have kids? How many kids will you have? Have you prepared well for old age and retirement? But these are the questions that people tend to have the greatest anxiety about. I mean, taken as a whole or together, they're questions about your viability and questions about your worldly success. These are the ones that we tend to get the most wound up about. And the answers to those questions do have a bearing on your happiness. They do affect your happiness. I'm not up here to say, oh, it's all spiritual, it's all good. It doesn't matter if you have money or you don't have money, or if you're in a bad marriage, you know, just love God, it's all going to be, you know, it's great. No, I don't go in for that. Christian-wise, New Age-wise, in any regard, I don't believe it. Some people on this earth are just as loving as I am, or just as spiritual as I am, or just as sinful as I am, and are much more unhappy than I am. It's not a question of just mindsets or things like this. Jesus, and we've been through the Gospel of Luke long enough now that I think everybody who's been in this series knows this completely well. Jesus never promises us that kind of happiness. That is not a promise in the Bible. In fact, if anything, he says, if you follow me, your worldly happiness is threatened more. I've lost my words, but your worldly happiness might come in under fire if you're following Christ. Now, he promises that he knows your needs. He promises that he knows your desires better than you do. He promises that he knows you intimately, and that when you're going through hard stuff, that he is there with you intimately, not just as a removed observer, but there with you. And he promises that your greatest desires will ultimately all be met through him. Those are all promises. Those are all things we can say in the Bible. We can point to those passages. We can rest on them. We can trust in them. We cannot say our worldly happiness is what we're here for. That's what we need to pursue, or that God is necessarily interested in your worldly happiness. But it's true that one of the reasons that the metrics of success put forth by our culture are so compelling is because we see greater happiness in people who have, you know, a good job, or more money, or a healthy marriage, or I don't know, the list of things, or people who have three kids are happier than those with two kids, right? You know, people who are charismatic or smart alecks tend to be happier in certain circumstances. But if the answer to the question, why are we here, is to be as happy as we can before we die, then worldly success becomes very important, of course, because that's how you become happy in this world. But I don't think that we're here to be as happy as we can be, speaking as someone who is pretty darn happy in his life. We're not here to be as happy as we can be. My beef with, you know, with all due respect, and try not to be too, but with the Joel Osteens of the world and like-minded pastors and theologians, is that they sort of start with this inference that God wants you to be happy on this world. And therefore, when you do things that make you happy, that you're fulfilling God's will in your life. And that can lead to some pretty heinous stuff. But according to Jesus, the answer to the question, why are you here, doesn't have anything to do with your worldly happiness. Why are we here? Well, according to this passage up here, which is why I jumped into this seeming tangent, we're here to decide who we're going to be when God is absent, or when God is distant, I should say. Or when God appears to be distant, is what I should say. We are here to decide who we're going to be when God appears to be distant. That's the whole point of that parable, it seems to me. If that slave says to himself, my master is delayed in coming. I thought he was going to be back in a couple hours, but it's been 6 hours, and who knows, maybe something happened, he's not coming back, maybe he left, maybe he's dead. But for whatever reason, party on. He's not here, and I'm just going to assume he's not coming back. Who are we when God seems distant? It put me in mind, too, of Genesis and the significance of that story, the fall, basically the fall of Adam and Eve. The significance of that story is that suddenly God becomes distant. And it's prefigured in the story where God suddenly becomes, you know, unaware of where Adam is, if you remember, after they've sinned. And God says in the garden, "Where are you?" Speaking to Adam. Which is a far deeper question than, of course, physical locality. He's asking Adam, "Where are you?" in a deeper sense. Where have you gone, Adam and Eve? And so it seems logical after the expulsion from the garden that we'd ask the same question back to God. Where are you? We put up this divide, we put up this distance, and we're hidden from each other in some very real way. Adam and Eve hid from God. God is hiding from us. However, God was able to find Adam and Eve by searching and calling. That's what he did in the story. He looks for them and calls out to them. So, likewise, we can find God by searching and calling out. God's distance creates pain and it creates doubt. It creates pain and it creates doubt. I've certainly experienced both in full measure in my 4 decades. Catching up, though. Pain and doubt. It also creates temptations, and that's what's dealt with in this parable for Jesus. What can we get away with? What can we get away with? God's distance creates that question in our mind. Not, I don't think, overtly. It's not something we're sitting around thinking about. But subconsciously, I think it does get deep down inside. What can we get away with in God's absence? There's no God, or at least he's so distant he doesn't care. All that matters is my personal worldly success. What can I get away with? What have we gotten away with in history? Oh, so much. We were just talking about slavery. Look, here's a continent full of people who are less organized and less technologically advanced than people of my skin color, my Western European heritage. Can we take some of these people and force them to do the work we'd rather not do to make money? If we take a few hundred, will God notice? Will God smite us? If we take a few thousand, a few hundred thousand, a few million? What if we torture them? What if we rape them? What if we just commit one of the worst atrocities in the history of human race? Will God notice? Will God do anything? What can we get away with? Because we're making money hand over fist with this. What can we do? Is anyone watching? Well, that's that story in a nutshell, I would say. It looks like no one's watching. Are we willing to bet our lives on that? And that's what worldly success can become at its worst. All those beautiful mansions built on the blood and bones of people being exploited. And God is silent. He does not smite. He does not punish. Is God dead? Did he never exist? He told us to love our neighbors as ourselves. He even told us to love our enemies. And kidnap slavery of that kind is even punishable by death in the Torah. But there's silence. There's nothing from the heavens. So there's two options then at that point, which the parable draws out, and which I'll draw out now. There's two options. And they're severe options. They're a thick line in the sand. One is that, or however you want to put it, or you know, that the universe was not created. The universe was not created. There is no God, no divine being. There's no love that permeates or binds us together. That is all just, it's a fantasy or a myth or a tale. It can be safely ignored. And therefore our morality, we really can construct a morality. We can say, you're inferior to me, and I can build my empire upon that. But the master of the slave will come on a day when he does not expect it. And there will be an unpleasant surprise, is the biblical story. That's a hard thing, but it's also on some level very good news. I prefer that to option one. Option two is that all of this, every bit of it, since we were expelled from the garden, where God unambiguously lived with us, every single thing, every aspect of this since the fall, is something of a sifting, a separating the wheat from the chaff. It's goats from sheep. It's a process. It's a test of sorts. Something like that. Who are we when God is delayed in coming to us? What are we going to do, rather, when God is delayed in coming to us? Who are we when we're let loose upon this earth and upon each other? Who among us is going to mourn God's distance and search for him and call out for him as God searched and called out for us and find him and proclaim he's risen and then live your life thusly? And who's going to say, well, look, a world for me to exploit and for me to be as happy as I possibly can and to do it on the backs of others? That's what we're doing here. That's what I believe this world is. That's what I think the whole story is about. There's a passage here from Acts I wanted to read. It's Paul in Athens talking to the Athenians. And Paul says, Athenians, he starts off with a bit of a joke. I don't know how it went over. It doesn't say in the New Testament. But he says, Athenians, I see how extremely religious you are in every way. For as I went through the city and looked carefully at the objects of your worship, I found among them an altar with the inscription, to an unknown God. See, that's funny. No, doesn't matter. What therefore you worship as unknown, I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, he who is Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in shrines made by human hands, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mortals life and breath and all things. From one ancestor he made all nations to inhabit the whole earth, and he allotted the times of their existence and the boundaries of the places where they would live so that, so this is Paul's, God made everything and made you and the nations and everything so that they would search for God and perhaps grope for him and find him, though indeed he is not far from each one of us. And that's, Paul is basically saying, you know, what I'm extrapolating from this parable, everything so that you may search for God, grope for him. I like that phrase, like groping in the dark, looking for him, and find him, because he actually isn't that far. And he ends it with this line, for we too, speaking to the Athenians, he says, for we too are his offspring, are his children, which is reminiscent of that movement from slave to son in that parable. For we are his children. We're here to search for God. That's what we're here to do. It will require groping. It will require calling out. It's not one thing you do once and then you're done. At least that's not in my view. I think that's a dangerous thing when Christians start to, you know, it's like you proclaim Christ as your Lord, you're baptized, and, well, get on with your life. You found God and you're done. I don't find that in the Bible. I find lots more passages like the kind we just read. They're like, be prepared. Make sure you're not caught naked at the wedding feast. Make sure that you're feeding your fellow, like we were just talking about or praying for earlier. Make sure that you're noticing your fellow brothers and sisters and caring for them, which is what he's commended for here. And then God will care for you. It's not about being perfect. Notice I haven't said sin in a long time. This is not about, none of you are going to achieve the level of perfection that of Christ, you know. Your sins are a given. This is about being prepared. And it's a lot less clear what that can mean. I mean, it's going to differ for each of us because it has to do with calling and where God is, where God wants you to be. And if there's some anxiety in you about that, then I would say, good. These passages weren't given to us for us to not be, we weren't supposed to read them and think, well, I've got that, you know. No, there should be some anxiety in us about that. We can trust in God's grace and we can cast our sin upon the cross. We should trust in God's grace and cast our sin upon the cross. But we can't do that one time and then wake every morning thereafter being like, well, I'm saved and to heck with the rest of you. That's not a kind of salvation. That's something else. The parable, this parable, in some ways, I'll close with this, is kind of reminiscent of Peter's reinstatement at the end of the Gospel of John. You know, Peter denies Jesus three times, and then Peter, Jesus reinstates him by saying, well, you know what he says. Do you love me? Yeah, Peter, do you love me? And Peter gets upset. He's like, of course I love you. Stop asking me this. And every time Jesus says, feed my sheep. Feed my sheep. Peter says, you know, do you love me? And Peter says, yes, feed my sheep. Three times. That's a sort of, that's, you know, very close anyway to the end of the gospel. That's something that's meant to stick with us, just as these passages are too. So, if we love God, feed his sheep. Let's pray.